today on Against the Grain, Walter Benjamin, the German-Jewish philosopher associated with the Frankfurt School, had a lot to say about violence and about the nation-state's role in propagating it. I'm C.S. James Martel joins me to discuss Benjamin's understanding of violence and of how to combat it, coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Why is there so much violence? From where does violence originate? And what forms of violence are most pernicious? And is nonviolence achievable? Can we somehow set aside violence and forge a different path? Walter Benjamin was a theorist and philosopher who wrote and thought about a lot of things, including the nature and manifestations of violence under capitalism. James Martel has written a trilogy of books about Walter Benjamin, who died in 1940 at the age of 48. Martel, who teaches political science at San Francisco State University, has also contributed an essay about Benjamin's theorization of violence to a volume called Histories of Violence, Postwar Critical Thought, edited by Brad Evans and Terrell Carver. When James Martel joined me recently in studio, I asked what initially attracted him to the writings and ideas of Walter Benjamin.
I think I read The Critique of Violence, I can't remember when, I think it was in graduate school, and I was very attracted to a few sentences where he talked about how the police, rather than being the kind of instantiation of the law and all of its rationality, were just basically people with guns walking around amidst you and anything could happen. And that very much appealed to me in my own kind of anarchist mentality.
What kind of topics and issues was Benjamin most drawn toward, most inclined toward investigating?
He was actually very omnivorous. He was very interested in political theology, first of all. So he had a lot of interest in Kabbalah and kind of Jewish mysticism. And he also was very interested in Marxism. And he was extremely interested in critiques of capitalism, but also in kind of the ways that capitalism promoted itself through culture and through architecture and through all of these kind of ways that one normally doesn't think of as political.
Did he feel like the Marxist tradition had kind of ignored or underemphasized culture, and so that's kind of what he wanted to foreground?
Yeah, I'm not sure he would have put it that way consciously, but I absolutely do think that's what he did, whether he thought it or not. He also admixed Marxism a lot with Jewish mysticism, which is also very unusual and makes him a very unique kind of Marxist, to put it mildly.
You write in this essay that Walter Benjamin had somewhat moderate views in his early years as a scholar. Tell us about that and what moved his opinions in a radical direction.
When he was first starting out as a student, he was interested in kind of progressive but not particularly radical kinds of schools of thought about education and about politics and things like that. But even at that age, he always sort of had an iconoclastic streak to him, so that he never quite fit into any of those groups. And he kind of started, you know, he would kind of get kicked out of one after the other. And his turn to radicalism came pretty naturally out of the way he thought.
And is this because of a growing disenchantment with the status quo as he investigated things further?
I think that's right. I think he never was that enchanted with the status quo, but I think he tried it on for size and discovered that he didn't like it. And after that, it was, you know, open season.
And he pursued a career in academia. What made him eventually give up the academic track?
Well, that wasn't by choice. He failed his second dissertation. In Germany, you have to write two dissertations. The second one's called the Habilitation, and it's one of my favorite books in the whole world. It's called The Origins of German Tragic Drama, but he presented it as a dissertation, and it was failed, so he couldn't continue in academia.
And why was it failed?
I think the people that read it just couldn't make any sense out of it. It's very complicated and very cryptic and dense, but it's also very beautiful and it has to be the best Habilitation ever written.
And is that partly because Benjamin's aesthetic sensibilities, first of all, that he emphasized them and then that they differed from other folks?
Oh, definitely. I mean, even that book, or if you want to call it that dissertation, is very atypical because one of the arguments that he makes is that the German Baroque tragic dramatists that he studies in that essay or that book were terrible. And it's for that very reason that he liked them, because he said in their incapacity to accurately portray gods and kings, he revealed the emptiness of those forms of political power. And if they'd been good playwrights, it wouldn't have worked.
Wow. A very unconventional argument.
Yes, for sure.
And so what did he do when he fell off the track, not by his volition?
He supported himself as best as he could through writing works of criticism, translation, different things. He moved to France at some point to escape from the Nazi rules. And then even in France, his ability to publish was constrained by the fact that he was Jewish because after France was occupied. So his economic life became increasingly reduced. And eventually he was sort of forced to live off money that was sent to him by people like Theodor Adorno in the United States.
What happened to him in September 1940?
He crossed over the Pyrenees to try to get away from Nazi Germany. And when he came to the border of Spain, by very bad luck, they had closed the border that day and they weren't accepting anyone. He was also told that he was going to have to report in the morning to some police officers. And in the night, he took his life with an overdose of sleeping pills.
Right. And so this was 1940 and he was born in 1892. So that's a very short life for this German Jewish theorist and philosopher. There's so much to be said about Benjamin and his life and his work and his ideas, but we are going to focus this hour on Benjamin on violence. And you point to the importance to Benjamin of the fall of Adam in the Garden of Eden, the importance of that to the existence of violence on Earth. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's a very important point for Benjamin, and it's probably a hard sell for a lot of people who aren't interested in religion. But for him, it's very, very critical, because the idea was that in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve had a job, which was to name the objects in the garden. And you could call that act presentation. In other words, they gave a spoken name to all these objects and kind of allowed them to present themselves. Once you have the fall and the expulsion from the garden, you have nothing but representation, right? Because the name no longer corresponds to the object. So human beings name everything, but Benjamin calls it overnaming. We have names in millions of different languages, and none of it is really an accurate name for what things are. So by definition, human beings after the fall are all fetishists, because we can't really present anything anymore. We can only represent things. But for that reason, we're always kind of estranged from the world and from the material world in particular. And that leads to a lot of the problems of the world for Benjamin. It's why we grasp after and try to control and determine everything. It's really the source of capitalism and fascism for him, because that disconnect between us and reality, our attempt to bridge it, we always do it in these very violent ways.
So before the fall of Adam and Eve in the garden, you are saying that they were somehow more in unity with other aspects of reality, of other things around them, and then something happened such that a separation occurred?
Exactly. And I mean, you don't have to take the story literally, or you have to be like a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim with that background to sort of take it. But I think it's just a way for Benjamin to illustrate our modern dilemma, which is our separation from the material world and the failure of language to correctly overcome that separation.
And so once again, what's the difference between presentation and representation?
Presentation is that you're actually experiencing the material world in front of you. You have a direct connection to it. And naming it is a way to sort of complement it. You give it a name as a way to sort of recognize it. Representation is an attempt to do the same thing when you have no access to that thing anymore. And that's the source of violence for Benjamin, because in our frustration that we're alienated from everything, we try to overcome it through the sort of force of projection. This is what Benjamin calls mythic violence. We're mythic because we're asserting a connection that we no longer have. And so to speak and to think and to engage with the material world, it by definition kind of forces us a kind of violence onto us.
So in some senses, Benjamin would say it is a natural impulse or inclination for us to be integrated into the world around us. And so this separation does cause us frustration, what, either conscious or unconscious, and from that emerges violence?
Exactly, exactly. The more we try to determine and own and dominate and control the things of the world, including other people, the more violent, the more fascist, and more capitalist we become.
So tell me more about mythic violence, because Benjamin, and you point this out in this essay, makes a distinction between mythic violence and divine violence. So mythic violence is what we've been talking about?
Exactly. It's in a way, it's Benjamin's name for law and politics as we practice it. It's the violence of assertion and of demanding that the world be a certain way, of taxonomizing everything, of hierarchicalizing everything. So it's a kind of violence that insists on having access to the world. It comes straight out of the Enlightenment for Benjamin, right? It's a response to the fall. It's a system of political organization such that there is an implicit denial of the fact that we have no access to the material world, and it's pretending that we do and that we can control it. So it leads to everything from, you know, environmental degradation to degradation of people to capitalism to fascism. These are all part of the same phenomenon for Benjamin.
Well, you could say, couldn't we say we have access to the material world, it's just that we don't give a damn about it? I mean, isn't that another possibility that ontologically we could say there was no fall? Let's say we don't, you know, believe in that whole story. So couldn't we say, well, we do have this connection, but, you know, we're just dismissive of it?
I think to think we have the connection is the mistake for Benjamin. Because what he requires from us is a kind of humility in the face of that not knowing. And that's kind of the proper political response. We have to, in a way, abandon the hope of representation because it leads us nowhere. And we have to sort of accept our alienation from the world, which is actually to ask a lot of us.
James Martell, professor of political science at San Francisco State University. He's authored a trilogy of books about the philosopher Walter Benjamin, and I was drawn to an essay he wrote about Benjamin's perspective on violence. It's part of the volume Histories of Violence, Postwar Critical Thought, edited by Brad Evans and Terrell Carver. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. What does Walter Benjamin mean by the term phantasmagoria?
That's a term that he actually gets from Marx, who was referring to a kind of magic lantern that was very popular, I think in the 18th century, which would project images on the wall, and it would spin and the images would appear to be alive and dancing. And for Marx, that was kind of a symbol for, or a term that he used to describe commodity fetishism and the way that the commodities are all fetishized and we all see these false realities before us. And that fits in very much with Benjamin and his idea of mythic violence, actually, because mythic violence creates the phantasmagoria. The phantasmagoria is what passes for reality in a world dominated by mythic violence. It's fake, it's fetishistic, it's false, but it's also very alluring and very seductive. So we're all entranced by it.
And fair to say that to fetishize something is to give it a certain kind of power?
Or to believe that we have a certain kind of power over it by knowing its name and by assuming that we know what it is and what it does and what it's used for. So it's a very instrumentalizing approach to the world.
Commodity fetishism then would be this applied to the things that we buy and sell?
Exactly. And this is a case where you see Benjamin's political theology mixing very interestingly with his Marxism, because of course commodity fetishism is a Marxist term, but in Benjamin's hands it takes on this whole theological aspect as well because of the question of representation and the fall and all of those kind of things that we talked about earlier.
And what do we make of kind of the theological underpinnings of much of Benjamin's work? I mean, you know, you said earlier you don't have to believe in this kind of stuff to really get Benjamin's point, but one could understand that somebody who's not into the Bible, not into mysticism, not into Judaism, you know, would feel like, well, maybe Benjamin is not for me, even though he shares certain radical perspectives that I happen to have.
Yeah, I hear that and struggle with that a lot, that exact sentiment. But I think a couple things. I think, first of all, this is just Benjamin's way of articulating something that a lot of other thinkers talk about without any recourse to the political theology. Like Jean-Luc Nancy is a great example. I think they're very similar spirits. And as far as I know, Jean-Luc Nancy has never mentioned God or prophets once. But at the same time, I think there is a value in using political theology to think about our current political situation, because if you believe, as I do, that our current modern, supposedly entirely secular world is actually really a theology disguised as secularity, you need to fight the fire of that crypto theology with an overt political theology, which is radical. And so I think it's actually very useful, because I think Judeo-Christian beliefs are actually at the base of a lot of the things that we don't think have anything to do with religion, to explicitly contrast them with or attack them with these explicitly theological terms as a way to sort of get the hair of the dog that bit us, as it were.
So how does commodity fetishism and the fetishism we've been talking about, how does it relate to Benjamin's view of the state as the source of violence? What and why is the state so, you know, in Benjamin's view and in mine, so bent on exerting violence?
Well, the connection to commodity fetishism is that the state is part of the apparatus that sustains capitalism, which is the kind of ultimate fetishistic system. And the problem for the state, as for the law, because he kind of makes a distinction between those two things, but in both cases, they claim a kind of origin and authority and ontological status that they actually don't have. It's a version of representation that we all do, but when in the case of the state and the law, the stakes are very high, because they claim to have this like absolute authority and this true origin and this right to do what they do and all these things, which are completely bogus. And it's very important for both of those institutions for us not to think of them as bogus. And so what they have to do, and Benjamin says this in the Critique of Violence, is they have to engage in a lot of aggression and violence in order to convince us and even itself that it has a right to exist.
And is this violence, does it emanate partly from the state's anxiety or insecurity in relation to its supposed legitimacy, which perhaps it understands it does not have?
That's exactly the problem. Anxiety is the perfect word. So the state must endlessly reproduce its own right to exist. Like, it has to do it every day. It has to kill or do something aggressive every day. Although I do want to make one point, which is that Benjamin uses the word violence. The German word that he uses is Gewalt, which means something more like power or force. So it's not necessarily physical stabby violence that we've been talking about this whole time, but just kind of the violence of like assertion and demanding to exist and just sort of imposing yourself into the world and instrumentalizing the world in that name.
And this form of violence, would you agree, Benjamin is more interested in than kind of human-on-human violence? Although, of course, that might disturb him.
Yeah, I think exactly. When he speaks about nonviolence, he's not talking about like Mahatma Gandhi-style nonviolence. He's talking about the eradication of those kind of assertions and the defeat of that kind of presumption of authority.
Walter Benjamin, he uses a story of Niobe from Greek mythology to illustrate his concept of mythic violence. What happens to Niobe?
So the story of Niobe is that she has, I believe, 12 children, and she brags about how many children she has. And in a way, she denounces Leto, who's the mother of Apollo and Artemis. And of course, Leto only had 2 children. So it was seen as kind of denigrating the gods. So in response, Apollo and Artemis kill all of Niobe's children. And then they turn Niobe into a weeping rock, which they set at the boundary between the human and the mortal realm. And Benjamin says of this that this is just what mythic violence is. So in order to assert their own right and their own power, the gods have to kill and have to make a very display of that killing and forever mark that display and that power. So they're kind of having to. So Niobe as a stone is kind of the marker of the endless need of the gods to prove that they exist over and over again. So it's mythic in that sense.
Okay, so that's mythic violence. And then we have divine violence. What does Benjamin mean by divine violence?
So divine violence is basically God's violence. And that sounds very strange to say that. But for Benjamin, God doesn't like having all of these lies told about God. And so God serves as a kind of an anarchist force to kind of counter all of mythic violence. So divine violence is really a way to sweep away fetishism and mythic violence, which is all done in God's name. And so that's a very critical point, because Benjamin sees God in a sense as an ally to those who struggle against fascism and capitalism.
And so divine violence doesn't have that necessarily have that connotation again of, you know, doing physical harm to somebody.
It can, but mostly it's just kind of a force that washes away all the lies of mythic violence. So it's not violent in a physical way necessarily, although it can be.
Who is Korah, and why does Benjamin draw on him, a biblical figure, to elucidate his concept of divine violence?
So Korah was a Levite priest who led a group of followers who contested Moses' right to speak for and through God. And God's response to that was to open the earth, swallow Korah and all his followers into the ground, and they disappeared forever. And Benjamin makes a point of this, that God doesn't have to show off. God doesn't have to leave a permanent sign the way Niobe is a permanent sign of mythic violence. There was no sign that Korah ever existed. And God is not insecure about divine power, so there doesn't need to be that kind of endless proof.
And that God does have to punish.
Yes, God does punish. I have a kind of a difference of opinion with a lot of people that talk about divine violence, because, for example, Slavoj Žižek says that divine violence happens when people rush out of the favelas and, like, you know, riot in the streets. And I read Benjamin differently. I think divine violence can only be done by God. And what divine violence does is it creates a space in which human beings can resist mythic violence. But we can't exercise divine violence. That's the way I read it.
His name is James Martel. He teaches political science at San Francisco State University. He's the author of a number of books. His latest is Unburied Bodies, Subversive Corpses and the Authority of the Dead. We've had him on to talk about The Misinterpolated Subject, another book of his. And I'm speaking with him today about violence and the philosopher Walter Benjamin's perspective on violence. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. So we've got mythic violence. We've got divine violence, which is maybe the answer to mythic violence. Where are humans in relation to these two phenomena?
That is the key question. So we are situated between these two sorts of violence. One is the state and the law asserting its own right to exist, which is false, and then God answering that violence with a counter-violence that sweeps it all away. And what that creates is a space for human beings to be, as Benjamin puts it, non-violent, which again doesn't necessarily mean that we won't kill anyone or hurt anyone. It means that we have a space that's not determined by all these lies, all this mythic violence, and then the rest is up to us. So it's very anarchist in that sense.
Talk more about that. Anarchist in what sense?
Well, it's anarchist in the sense that I actually think of anarchism as an extremely secular way of being. And so because kind of divine violence has canceled out mythic violence, these kind of theological and counter-theological forces have canceled each other out, and you're left a space that's secular. It's anarchist, in other words, where human beings can make their own judgments about what to do and how to live their lives.
And not just secular, but also kind of not based on or appealing to authority?
Exactly. Rather than sort of take the word of the state or the law that I exist and I demand that you do X, Y, and Z, this turns that political power and legal authority back to the community itself. And it's in that space that people can make their own decisions and have their own power and engage in that power nonviolently.
So pure means is a notion forwarded by Benjamin, by Walter Benjamin. What is it and what is its relationship to violence?
Yeah, Benjamin uses that term a lot, and what he means by it is that pure means are when your means, the way you do things, is cut off from your ends, because ends are always fetishistic. You're always like projecting into the future, and you're always thinking about what your aims are, and those are almost inevitably going to be fetishistic. So if you actually break away from those ends and just focus on the means themselves, the means for Benjamin transform into something else. They become a way to sort of allow you to make your own decisions in real time rather than always going towards a future that seems to already be determined.
Does he provide a blueprint on how to realize pure means in one's own life?
One great example that he offers, and one of the few really, really concrete things he suggests, is his notion of the general strike. And he says the general strike is a revolutionary action of pure means, because unlike most what he calls political strikes, which are you and I normally call strikes by unions and other things, those are basically a way to blackmail the state to use violence against violence, to try to make some kind of deal and arrangement with the state that doesn't fundamentally challenge capitalism and fetishism. A general strike is just to say no to the whole thing. So there's no ends. Right? There's just means. The general strike is the means, but there's no end. There's no negotiation. It's just an absolute turning your back on the whole system. And that is a truly radical way to approach thinking about engaging in economics and politics and social life and all those kind of things.
So like a traditional labor strike, because it's about in some ways coercing management to make concessions, to give you more pay, to increase one's benefits, that is violent in Benjamin's sense?
Yes, because you've effectively accepted the basics of capitalism. You are going to get a wage, you are going to be exploited, you are going to give some amount of profit to these overlords who do whatever they're going to do with it. And so you want more money, yes, but you're not actually overthrowing the entire system that's oppressing you. So it's not radical in that sense.
What would a strike, let's say a general strike called, let's say in Europe where, you know, everything stops, thousands of people just stop doing things and everything grinds to a halt. I mean, isn't there an end to those means, namely telling the authorities things can't go on the way they have and something has to change?
You're making a radical rupture with the status quo. So I don't necessarily think of that as an end in itself. I just think it's an end of ends, if you will. And instead, what you get is an actual return to a kind of anarchist life that we're always living for Benjamin, but not under the shadow of this like mythic violence. For Benjamin, every single day, you and I and everyone else in the world practices many, many examples of nonviolent interactions with other persons, with other, you know, you decide what you're going to do, you do this, you do that, you work it out amongst yourselves. Now, it's true that the state takes all the credit for all those decisions and tells us that we couldn't do anything without it, that we'd all be stabbing each other in 5 minutes if it wasn't for the state. But that's like a grand theft of that kind of horizontal authority, right? When they say those kind of things. And in fact, we practice anarchism constantly. So a general strike is really just a way to allow that practice to be kind of uncovered and to be itself rather than always be kind of in reference to this kind of overarching mythic structure.
Does Benjamin have in mind a particular revolutionary event in history that he thinks aligns most closely with a general strike in, you know, in his mind?
I think there were several historical moments that he is interested in. He's very interested in the Paris Commune, like virtually every leftist, and the French Revolution. But one of the wonderful things about Benjamin is that he also sees this kind of resistance in some of the most mundane and kind of normal daily life. You know, it doesn't always have to be this great event. And I think that's also very anarchist of him, that he doesn't sort of fetishize one period of time over another. So he does like to talk about all the past revolutions, and they're very important for him. But I think he thinks that resistance and that kind of revolutionary possibility happens every day.
Every time, perhaps, we refuse what the state demands of us?
Or even every time we do something that has nothing to do with the state, we're actually reasserting the way the state doesn't matter.
That's the voice of James Martel, professor of political science at San Francisco State University. We'll take a short break and speak more with James about the German Jewish theorist Walter Benjamin and what he said and wrote about violence. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. James Martell teaches political science at San Francisco State University. His books include The Misinterpolated Subject, and his new book is Unburied Bodies, Subversive Corpses and the Authority of the Dead, published by Amherst College Press. We are talking about some investigations he's done into Walter Benjamin's perspectives on violence. And you can read about it in the volume Histories of Violence, Postwar Critical Thought. That book is published by Zed Books. So is nonviolence is clearly a goal for Walter Benjamin. The absence of violence, does he see that as a realizable goal? Does he think that violence can be eliminated altogether?
I don't think he thinks that violence can be eliminated altogether, because this is where the political theology becomes important. Because of the fall, we're always going to have this problem. We're always going to be fetishists, each and every one of us. So we're never going to be free from violence. And I think he teaches us to be very suspicious of people who tell you that you can be, because that's the day when you fall into full fetishism. Because, of course, liberalism pretends to be absolutely nonviolent, right? And it's extraordinarily violent. So that you kind of return to exactly what you're resisting. So I would say nonviolence is a goal, but also, as I was saying earlier, it's also a daily practice. So we're kind of already doing it. I would say the goal is not just nonviolence per se, but to reduce the amount of mythic violence in proportion to that nonviolence. It's more like that. It's more like flipping it so that we do more nonviolence than violence, whereas in our current practice, it's the other way around.
How do you view that sense of Benjamin that we kind of are in a natural state? Right, we're fallen, such that violence is there or is a distinct possibility. I mean, doesn't that kind of put humanity in a kind of straitjacket that maybe it doesn't need, in some people's opinion?
I think for him, the value of thinking that way is not so much necessarily the kind of theological point about human nature, because I think he also teaches us to be very suspicious of any claim about human nature. But it teaches us to be very suspicious of the idea that we can walk away from violence, because I think he wants us to keep our eye on it. It's constantly reasserting itself. It's very clever. It's very Hydra-headed, and it shows up constantly all over the place. So it's more like a Trotskyite version of Endless Revolution than, you know, kind of across the finish line and you're done. I think that's very much where Benjamin lives. And actually, Trotsky's Endless Revolution is an example of how you can say the same thing without recourse to theological language.
What about violence toward the end of self-defense?
Yes, actually, so Benjamin is very interesting about that. He says at one point that the biblical commandment, thou shalt not kill, can't be read as an absolute edict. And instead, it has to serve as a kind of a guideline that we have to ponder and struggle with, both by ourselves and in community with others. I think that's a very telling point about Benjamin. And he actually includes the Jewish justification for murder and self-defense as an example of a time when those in that community decided that they could kill, even though it says, thou shalt not kill. It shows you that even when it comes to God, Benjamin is very anarchist, that he won't take anything as an absolute perfect edict, that each situation you have to come to anew, and you have to struggle with it and think about it and decide what you're going to do. Even if you yourself have refrained from violence in the past, and I'm talking about physical violence in this case, you may have to decide to do it in the future. But what's really important, I think, is that Benjamin strips you of the ability to say, oh, I had to kill because I was commanded to, or it was the right thing to do. You're not allowed to say that. If you kill, it's on you or on you as a community, and you bear the full responsibility of that thing. And I think that that in and of itself would vastly reduce the amount of actual physical violence that happens in a world that was run on Benjaminian principles as opposed to the world that we actually live in.
This notion of responsibility, personal responsibility, individual responsibility, we can't, you know, put it on somebody else. Makes me want to ask, was he drawn in any way to existentialism?
I think so. I think he in a way, there is something very existentialist about him, in the kind of a great agnosticism that he kind of practices. But I think there's something a little bit more pointed about Benjamin than a lot of existential thinkers. I think that he puts more focus than they might on politics, because I think there's individual responsibility, but there's also collective responsibility. And he actually was, both of those things were very important to him. So he very much believed not in like an isolated individual making their own choices, but rather in groups of people collectively determining things. That's the kind of daily anarchism that he was really interested in, I think.
So it would be lovely if social movements, if radical social movements borrowed from and used Benjamin's ideas and critiques. Have they?
Well, it's actually interesting. I think in his own lifetime, a lot of people would have been surprised to know that Benjamin would become more famous than they were. I think that's certainly happened to Adorno, and it's arguably even happening to Hannah Arendt, which is kind of a shocker. So I think Benjamin has become very, very big, you know, very, very important and cited in a lot of different cases. But, you know, like any other big philosopher, I think there's lots of camps and different groups, and there's different readings. So I alluded to earlier this discussion of what divine violence means. Like, can people exercise divine violence? Yes or no? You know, he doesn't have like these perfect answers for everything. And I think that he makes himself particularly unavailable to be kind of turned into a dogmatist. You know, it's hard to be dogmatic about Benjamin because he's very anti-dogmatic himself. And I think he tries very hard not to exercise a lot of textual authority to kind of command you to think this and not that. He really does throw things back on the reader.
If negotiation and compromise is not what Benjamin would prescribe because it means engaging with something that he considers to be violence and something to be rejected, what is an example of a social movement or two that didn't engage with the state in a very pointed way that Benjamin would approve of, say?
Well, there are certain political leaders that Benjamin liked very much, like Blanqui, who was one of the leaders of the movement that led up to the Paris Commune. So there are political leaders that do that kind of stuff. Although I want to say once again that because Benjamin is really, truly anarchist, I think he tries not to kind of lionize certain people at the expense of others. And in a way, the great heroes of Benjamin's writing are ordinary people. Like, for example, a lot of people talk about this figure in one of his books, The Arcades Project, the flâneur, which is just this person that's sort of walking around Paris not doing anything. that is a kind of heroic figure for Benjamin, a resistor and somebody who's not engaged in violence, not the violence of capitalist fetishism that's swirling all around them, right? So the flâneur is an example of a very ordinary person who doesn't seem to be doing a whole lot, who nonetheless kind of has this heroic or maybe anti-heroic quality.
Occupy Wall Street, it refused to come up with a program of action. Was that a good thing or a bad thing in your view and in Benjamin's view if he were around?
Yeah, I think were Benjamin around, he would definitely say that the minute you start to come up with a list of demands is the minute you give up, the minute you give yourself over to what you're fighting. There's a famous meeting between Hillary Clinton and some of the leaders of Black Lives Matter where she said, just give me a list of demands, and they wouldn't do it because what they're calling for is the end of white supremacy, not like this, this, and this. You know what I mean? And I think that's very much in the spirit of Benjamin, too. Like, once you start negotiating and working things out, you have basically fundamentally compromised with the very force that you are resisting.
And so perhaps to recapitulate, what would then Benjamin want a social movement to do?
I think he would want a social movement to maximally resist all of the ways that mythic violence was being projected onto that community, and in that space allow it to do what it does. So if you take, you know, Occupy Wall Street as an example, I think Occupy Wall Street, from a Benjaminian perspective, was a success as itself. You know, it's true that it ended and it was, you know, it could be read as a failure in that sense. But for Benjamin, the ability to create a space, a political space in which all of this nonviolent life was happening was very much the point. And again, I think for Benjamin, failure and success don't come in these kind of all at once, you know, absolute models where you cross the finish line. It's very episodic and sporadic. And he had a very strong sense of each so-called failed revolution being part of a continuity that was kind of collectively challenging mythic violence.
I'm talking about Walter Benjamin, the German Jewish theorist and philosopher, born 1892, died 1940, with my guest in studio, James Martell, professor of political science at San Francisco State University. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. In one of his essays, Benjamin wrote about a weak messianic power. What is that?
So that is a word that he uses for that what I have been calling the kind of human space of resistance that's afforded by divine violence, but isn't divine violence itself. In other words, it's a weak messianic power because we do have this ability to push back and resist and fight back against fascism or capitalism or whatever you want to call it. It's weak in the sense that it's not usually viewed as a power at all, but I think it can actually be incredibly forceful because, as you can see in a lot of historical instances, when like there's this widespread rejection of the status quo, that power collapses in seconds.
Right. If the people don't support the power collapses.
Right, because the power never existed in the first place. Right. That's why the power has to constantly reassert itself. And the minute the people call its bluff, it returns the power to its own nothingness, as it were.
Do we then, and maybe you said this earlier, but do we then fetishize the state? I mean, is that part of our dilemma? Our impulse to fetishize authority puts us in a very bad position.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's very important to stress that for Benjamin, every single one of us will always be a fetishist, and we should never forget that. And so, yes, that's part of the way that the state survives and thrives is because the word the state is a name that demands an object. So there must be a thing called the state, and it has all these qualities and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. So we actually help it dominate us just by calling it something.
So you open this essay, or, you know, near the beginning of this essay, again, it's about Walter Benjamin's perspective on violence. It's in the volume History of Violence, Post-War Critical Thought. You mention your belief that Walter Benjamin is fundamentally, or in large part, an anarchist. Can you talk more about what anarchism means to you? I mean, that word's come up a lot in this hour, but I want kind of you to flesh out, you know, the heart of anarchism and maybe some of its features that aren't so fundamental, but that are important.
The first thing to say is that I don't believe that Benjamin ever called himself an anarchist, or maybe he did when he was kind of younger, but he definitely called himself a communist for most of his life. And I have no problem with that. Like, whatever term you want to use, I prefer the term anarchism because I think it more accurately portrays what Benjamin was doing, which is to say that it's the opposite of what I like to call archism, which is a word we don't use very much, but I wish we used all the time, which refers to virtually all these other kind of models of politics, which are based on hierarchy, on taxonomizing people, on instrumentalizing everything, on controlling and determining and domineering and all that stuff. I think archism is a great term. So anarchism is the system that opposes, or the political system that opposes archism. And I think the basic idea, if we want to use it in contemporary terms, is that archism, or the, let's just speak of the state in this case, but of course archism is more than the state. It's also capitalism. It's everything. But if we just want to talk about the state for a second, it sits parasitically on this vast living body of people, you know? And like I said earlier, the state insists that we couldn't exist without it, that everything that we do that's good and true is thanks to the state or to the law. And it actually projects its own chaos and violence onto what it calls anarchism. So normally when we think of anarchism, we think of people stabbing each other, you know, Mad Max, blah, blah, blah. It's really the state that is completely chaotic. Capitalism is completely chaotic, and it insists on being ordered and rational. And that's like one of the most violent aspects of mythic violence that I can think of, that kind of transfer of its own chaos and violence onto that which opposes it. Right. To me, anarchism is actually very orderly. That's not to say that it's kind of conscripted and you know what's going to happen in advance. But when people kind of work things out together, that's a kind of organization. That's a kind of orderliness. Right. That's opposed to whatever the state does. So the state spends this enormous amount of time and energy trying to pose itself as being this ordered, peaceful, good, rational thing when it's not any of those things. And that's also true for capitalism. And that's where like a huge expenditure of energy in archism goes, right? So anarchism doesn't have to fight that uphill battle. It really is sort of like at rest with itself. It is just what it is, as opposed to trying to pretend to be something else. So I think in a funny way, even though it seems like archism has all the power and anarchism is on the outside, that it's actually anarchism that really has the kind of the universe on its side, because archism has to always fight the uphill battle to control, to dominate, to determine what isn't true.
Let's say the state went away. Let's say the state withered away. And so you just have people who are anarchist-minded. So how would they govern themselves? Would they put up something that might, you know, be called a state? What kind of institutions do you think they would need in order to govern themselves?
This is something that, of course, Benjamin doesn't tell us very much about. But I think that kind of in keeping with some of his suggestions, and just in terms of thinking of anarchism more generally, I think what you would have is something like small, like workers' councils or local councils that kind of, you know, determine their own interests and then deal through spokes councils, all the kind of models that came out of the Spanish anarchist movement that have been adopted kind of universally by anarchists all over the world. And I think there's also a economic version of this. I always like to ask my students who all are working because they're at SF State and they need to have jobs. Has your manager or your boss ever done anything that you couldn't have figured out yourselves? And the answer is inevitably no. So if you think of these layers of parasitism that insist that they do everything and you need them, thank God you have them, otherwise you would just fall apart. I think that the shop floor knows what it needs to know. I think the political groups know what they need to know. God knows at a university like where I work, the administration doesn't add anything. They take money, they take time, they make us miserable. We don't need any of those things. So I think the anarchist world that I'm envisioning would look exactly like this world minus all those parasitic layers. So in some ways, it wouldn't change very much. And there's a lovely saying by Benjamin, which actually comes from Jewish mysticism, which is that when the Messiah comes, they would only like move one pebble over 1 inch or something like that. I forgot exactly how they put it. But it really suggests to me how you can change things radically with a very, very small adjustment. He calls it a slight adjustment, actually. And that adjustment would be getting rid of all those layers. And so most of life could go along, but it would have fundamentally and radically changed because it would be working for itself rather than on behalf of some false overlord.
I've been reading this term, necropolitics, and I think that relates to the state and the way it functions in relation to death, and often, I guess, the death of subjects of the state. What is your sense of what necropolitics, or perhaps what the state's role is in relation to death, and how anarchism might be a counterforce to that?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. So obviously, necropolitics is kind of a reference to the way that bodies pile up due to state violence, right? Like states are continually have to kill, and so they kill a lot. And so that's kind of like the context for necropolitics. But I think that term also suggests like a deeper connection between the state and death, because I really think that anarchism is about life and all of its complexity. And in a way, I would say the state is about death, but it's not even exactly about death, because death is a natural part of life. And death is an important aspect to life. So it's really about non-life. I think the state is not a living thing. Of course, the people who represent the state are alive, they're people, but the state as such and capitalism as such and all of these archist structures are not alive. They suck life out of the living and use it for their own purposes, but they are not themselves alive. And that's why it's so easy to return them to nothingness, because they don't have any actual life of their own. They only live other people's lives. If that makes sense.
James Martell, professor of political science at San Francisco State University. Your new book is called Unburied Bodies, Subversive Corpses and the Authority of the Dead. What's this book about?
This book came to me kind of inspired by thinking about two different images of unburied bodies. One is from the play Antigone, which is Antigone's brother Polyneikes, who's left outside of the city of Thebes to rot. And Antigone buries him, and for that crime, she's arrested and buried alive and all this stuff. And the other image is Michael Brown, who was killed in the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, and left in his own blood for many hours. And the idea that motivated this book was that these bodies seem to be the acme of state power, the moment of its absolute triumph. But at the same time, they are also a sign of the state's deep vulnerability, because it has to demonstrate its existence through a particular reading of these bodies. And if these bodies can be read in different ways, that gets right at the heart of their power and really challenges the state.
So in what sense then can a corpse be subversive? Is that all about changing our own understandings of what an unburied body is?
Well, and this comes back to Benjamin, actually. For Benjamin, when we bury bodies and when we do funerals and so on and so forth, we are returning that body to a place where it can no longer challenge our ideas about what that subject did and was, right? While we're alive, we're very vulnerable to kind of reflecting back onto archism and the state, the kind of whatever meanings that it wants to give us. We're very obedient in that way. But dead bodies don't play that game. They're just there, and they kind of return to their materiality. And for Benjamin, especially when bodies start to rot, they really kind of exercise their own separate autonomy that doesn't play along with what mythic violence insists that it is. So in their rotting materiality, these dead bodies are really subversive and really challenge what all of us, the living, think that we are and what we are doing.
That's fascinating. And yet it also kind of does suggest, at least to me, not having read this book, that I mean, what you're not trying to say is that you have to be dead in order to be truly subversive, right?
No, absolutely, yes. Although that would be a terrible message. Now, what I'm saying actually is, and I look at various different readings in this book, is that rather than try to tell the dead body what it means and try to return it to the kind of subjectivity that we all suffer from, I'm suggesting that we allow the dead bodies to tell us what we are, right? To sort of reverse that process and to put ourselves in the stream of that dead body and let it disrupt our own sense of who we are and what we are. And in that way, it can radicalize us. And I'm suggesting that's exactly what Antigone did with her brother, and that's what the Black Lives Matter movement did with Michael Brown.
James Martel, his latest book is Unburied Bodies, Subversive Corpses and the Authority of the Dead. He's written a trilogy of books about the philosopher Walter Benjamin. He's written about Benjamin and violence, which is part of the volume Histories of Violence, and he teaches political science at San Francisco State University. James, lovely always to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.